From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd, and this week for Jeremy Hobson, it's Here and Now. German Chancellor Angela Merkel is facing the biggest challenge of her 12 years as the country's leader. Talks to form a new coalition government have collapsed after 4 weeks of negotiations. A vote on September 24th left Merkel's two-party conservative bloc without enough support to form a government on its own. And now there's a chance that new elections will be held. Joining us now from Berlin is the BBC's Damian McGuinness. And Damian, how big of a crisis is this for Angela Merkel?
Well, certainly the country has never had a political crisis quite like this. It's a complete stalemate right now here in Berlin. The political parties who would be able to help Angela Merkel form a government have refused to do so. So that's the free market liberals walked out of coalition talks on Sunday night. And the other parties that are prepared to work with her, such as the Green Party, don't have enough seats really to reach a majority. So what we're now seeing is there's a lot of pressure growing on all parties to somehow come up with a solution, because the only other option would be fresh elections. So for Angela Merkel, this really is a crisis. Having said that, Mrs. Merkel has already survived various crises in the past. And it really depends what happens now over the next few hours, the next few days, and how the public debate goes, because already we're seeing some of those smaller parties blamed for the breakdown. She has no other rivals in her own party. So the more unstable things become politically here in Germany, the more that Mrs. Merkel could, in fact, be seen as a sign of stability, because that's often what's happened in the past. When things have looked wobbly, people have actually turned to Angela Merkel to keep things stable. So it's looking difficult for her right now, but we can't say that her political career is dead in the water. Hmm. It really depends what happens over the next few days.
Well, let's take a look back at what happened in September with this election. There was support for the far right, the AfD party. It's an anti-immigration party. Won seats in parliament for the first time. A lot of people there in Germany say that was in response to Merkel's softening stance on refugees. What role has all that played in this crisis now, her inability to form this government?
Yeah, you're quite right to look back there, Peter, because it is actually the results of those elections have led to that crisis effectively. So this was, as you say, elections 8 weeks ago. Six parties got into the German parliament, the Bundestag. That is an unusually high number for Germany, and that is because of this new anti-Islam AfD party. And they won 90 seats in parliament. So what this meant is that the other mainstream parties won fewer seats, particularly Chancellor Angela Merkel's centre-right Christian Democrats. And what this meant is that to get a majority, Mrs. Merkel was forced to try to cobble a coalition between four different parties. Usually in Germany, there's a coalition, so that's not unusual. But a coalition between four parties is unusual. Usually you have possibly two, possibly three different parties. So these different parties all have very strong ideological differences. We're talking ranging from left-leaning Greens right through to conservative CSU, through to fervently pro-business, pro-free market liberals. And it was always going to be difficult to bring together those four different parties to a governing coalition to make a stable agreement. But the breaking down of talks on Sunday night did come as a surprise. And they really broke down because one of these parties, the Liberal FDP, just walked out of the talks and said, this is not working for us and we're not able to form a government. So that's where the crisis has now been sparked.
You've mentioned the stability that many people there think that Angela Merkel has brought to Germany and by extension to Europe. If there is a new election, could we be looking at a Germany without Angela Merkel?
It's hard to say right now because so many things are up in the air. All of the mainstream parties are in agreement that new elections would lead to at least a certain period of political instability, which could potentially have an impact on the economy and which is certainly very bad for the rest of Europe. The atmosphere right now here in Germany is very fluid, and it's hard to predict whether parties are going to stick to their tough talking language, because we are talking in time of political crisis, and it could well be that political leaders step down or at least change their minds. What we saw earlier today was Germany's president, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, issued a speech in which he gave a harsh rebuke to all political leaders, saying they had a responsibility to be prepared to talk and to come up with a governing coalition. So the pressure is growing on political leaders to agree and to try and avoid fresh elections. If fresh elections did happen, though, it would certainly be a challenge for Angela Merkel, to say the least.
That's the BBC's Damian McGuinness speaking to us from Berlin. Damian, thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
Well, a personal note now. My brother, an actor named John Savage, had an agent named Rudy Altobelli and was staying in the guest house at Rudy's home on Cielo Drive in Los Angeles in 1969. But he happened to be away the night that the murderous followers of cult leader Charles Manson brutally slaughtered other guests. The pregnant actress Sharon Tate, wife of director Roman Polanski, coffee heiress Abigail Folger, hairdresser Jay Sebring, Polish movie director Wojciech Frykowski, and Stephen Parent. The followers went on to kill grocery owners Lino and Rosemary LaBianca, writing the words helter skelter and pigs in the victims' blood on the walls, hoping to start a race war. Well, they appalled and maybe changed the country. Manson died last night in prison at 83. His life has been documented in books and movies. It is a disturbing story of a disturbed man who mutated out of the hippie flower child movement of the day. And to mark the death, we want to bring in author Ed Sanders. He was a rock and roller in the 60s in the band The Fugs. He went on to write one of the definitive books on Manson. It's called The Family. He joins us from his home in upstate New York. And Ed, you knew him, communicated with him. Your thoughts when you hear the name Charles Manson and that he's died?
Well, I did investigate him for a number of years, and we exchanged letters, and he was a very troubled person. Born in 1934 in West Virginia, his mother apparently neglected him severely. He began a series of jail terms in the fall of 1949. Age 15, and then he was in and out of jail for literally the rest of his life, except for a couple of years stint from 1967 till October of 1969, when he used techniques of hypnotism and running women as a pimp. He used those techniques to create this wandering group of nomads that I call the family.
Well, they were mistaken for hippies. They were not. They were, you know, runaways and other lost souls that, you know, he managed to what? I mean, you say hypnotize, but what was it? He's been called charismatic. What was the draw?
He, at a Grateful Dead in 1967, experienced on LSD the Stations of the Cross, and he thereafter confused himself with Jesus. And he attracted mainly girls, but a lot of guys who were attracted to the sexual activities of the group. But anyway, he attracted these young women who he convinced he was a Jesus figure, and then he would make love with them on LSD and other drugs. It's a powerful recruiting tool if you believe your cult leader is Jesus and you're making love with him.
Well, he befriended rock stars, including the Beach Boys' Dennis Wilson. He fancied himself a songwriter. Some say when his songs were rejected, that was a trigger for this violence. This is a sick, sick man. I mean, some people say there's a thin line between sick and evil.
Well, he had elements of evil in his personality, but he very much wanted to be a star. He was confused, though, thinking that if you could just get a record contract, it would automatically mean you became rich. And so he was convinced, and he tried to get Dennis Wilson, the drummer of the great band, the Beach Boys, and Terry Melcher, a big league producer for Apple Records, tried to get them to get him a record out.
And yet he was obsessed with Beatles music, including Helter Skelter. That's where
right. He
took his thinking that, you know, the end of the world was coming. Helter Skelter is coming down. His followers, those who were jailed, do you think they'll ever be let out?
I don't know. I have a divided mind because during the trial, one of the defense attorneys showed me a photo of the dead Sharon Tate all cut up, and it was the worst thing I had ever seen in my life, and I vowed to, in my book, when I saw that photo, to really present these people not as innocent, hippy-dippy people traveling around in a converted school bus, innocently smoking pot, but as a driven cult of serial murderers.
For those who are trying to grasp how shocking these murders were and, you know, get a sense of the time in which it came, would you agree with those who say it was sort of the end of what was seen as the flower power hippie era? It was sort of an end of innocence.
This tended, along with the war in Vietnam, to put an end to the summer of love, which occurred in 1967 when everybody was, you know, traveling around in Volkswagen microbuses and wearing peacock feathers in their hair. That ended when the stark reality of things such as what Manson and his group did.
That's Ed Sanders, author of The Family, the biography of Charles Manson, who died last night at 83. Ed, thank you.
Okay.
Weekend box office results are in, and the superhero flick Justice League topped the list. And a surprising second is Wonder. The film took in about $27 million, triple what experts had predicted. In Wonder, Jacob Tremblay plays 10-year-old Augie, who's been homeschooled all his life. But as the film opens, Augie's about to leave that safe cocoon for traditional middle school. His entire family, including his mother, played by Julia Roberts, sees him off.
I'll meet you right here after school, okay? Right here. I love you.
Love you too.
I'll see you later.
Now, the first day is tough for any kid, but for Augie, it's even worse. He was born with a form of Treacher-Collins syndrome, causing severe facial deformities that 27 surgeries could not fully correct. Wonder is based on the best-selling book by R.J. Palacio, and she joins us along with Stephen Chbosky, who directed and co-wrote the screenplay. Welcome to you both. And R.J., this movie exists because you wrote a book that was inspired by a real-life event with your own kids. What happened?
About 10 years ago, I was with my two children, and my younger son was only about 3 years old at the time, and we found ourselves sitting next to a little girl who had a very significant craniofacial difference. And, you know, my little boy started to cry, and in my haste to shield the little girl from seeing his reaction to her face, I just kind of whisked him away without really stopping to think that from her point of view or from her mom's, it might have looked like, you know, I was trying to shield him from seeing her face. And anyway, that just got me thinking a lot about what it must be like to face a world every day that doesn't really know how to face you back. And Natalie Merchant's song Wonder came on the radio that night, and I don't know, it just kind of clicked for me that this seemed like a good moment to write a book.
And that Natalie Merchant song, just remind us why that was critical. If I remember the lyrics, it was something like, "You doctors came from distant cities just to see me."
Yeah. And I am a wonder of God's own creation. And there were, you know, it's a beautiful song filled with such optimism and hope and kind of an embracing of the difference, whatever it is. It's unnamed in the song. And it really doesn't matter. It's just about embracing one's uniqueness and almost turning it into an anthem.
They say I must be one of the wonders God's own creation. And as far as they see, they can offer no explanation. Ooh, I believe fate smiled at destiny.
I wanted to write a book full of hope and optimism.
Well, you've captured the hope through your character, Augie. He's trying to make it through his first year of traditional school. He had been homeschooled by his mother, but he has this really difficult disorder, Treacher-Collins syndrome. I imagine you had to research what that was. What did you learn throughout the course of writing the book?
You know, at first, I wasn't even going to mention what it was he had. In fact, in the book, I never actually come out and name it as Treacher-Collins. And the reason was because ultimately what his facial difference is doesn't really matter as much as the fact of his difference. You know, the fact that in the fifth grade, it doesn't take much to set you apart and, you know, an easy target of bullies or, you know, social isolation. But I did do a lot of research about different craniofacial syndromes, and I did ultimately decide to describe his face just because I when I started shifting points of view, it seemed like it was an important part. Because, you know, Augie doesn't really spend too much time thinking about what he looks like. He knows he looks different, and he just, you know, it didn't seem like it was that relevant to Augie in the first person.
You know, we had a lot of kids visit the set who have the Chicha Collins and other things. And the thing that I found amazing was maybe the adults around them would want to talk about their surgeries, or the adults around them would want to talk about their struggles. The kids themselves don't. They want to talk about Star Wars and baseball and football or whatever. And that's what was so remarkable about the journey for me, because I didn't know anything about Chicha Collins or really any of these conditions that we've been talking about until I started doing the film. And it really opened my eyes that, you know, ultimately that kids have an amazing, amazing resilience, and they give us a lot of hope.
And kids who have to go to school on the first day can be nervous. Let's listen to a little more of that scene from Augie's first day at school. Here he is with his father, who is played by Owen Wilson.
Two rules. First, only raise your hand once a class, no matter how many answers you know, except for science. Crush the wall.
Check.
Second, you're going to feel like you're all alone, Augie, but you're not.
Check.
That little voice there, Jacob Tremblay playing Augie. What a talented young man. Stephen, this is a kid who took on a role that would be challenging for an experienced adult to understand all the nuance.
Yeah. Well, Jacob is he's a complete prodigy when it comes to acting. He's well beyond his years. His amount of preparation, the people that he spoke with, he did a lot of research. He had binders of letters of kids and families, so he wanted to pay tribute to them. And I've never seen such professionalism in such a young person.
It's not that I thought that the kids out-acted the superstars. You know, I know I went to this film expecting to see Julia Roberts there, but at the end of the day, it was the kids who stole the show. And I wonder if you wanted it to be that way, Stephen.
I think that we all did. You know, look, I think Julia and Owen and Mandy Patinkin and David Diggs and all the grown-ups are fantastic. And I think incredibly selfless and should be commended for taking a supporting role to the kids. When we started making the film, for really the first 2 weeks was all the little kids. And we established a real tone on set. They did, just with their enthusiasm. And they were so generous with each other. And they were so fun. And, you know, I will admit, occasionally hard to wrangle. I'm not gonna lie. But what they brought with it such an authenticity. They weren't trying to, quote, act. They were just trying to be kids. And they were trying to you know, be truthful about these situations. It was very inspiring to all of us. And I have to say, when the grown-ups started showing up and the teenagers started showing up, they knew the bar was incredibly high. And they were nervous because, you know, the kids had set the tone and we were all trying to follow them.
You know, we expect Julia Roberts and Owen Wilson. You know, we've come to expect that they're going to be amazing,
yeah.
You know. And I remember seeing David Diggs in Hamilton and just being wowed. But these kids, you know, I certainly, other than Jacob, I'd never heard of them. And they brought such a depth and a range of emotion to their roles. And I think that was such a part of what Stephen did with them, that he was able to get these really sort of natural performances from kids, because that was the one thing I was a little hesitant about when we first talked about doing this movie, you know, that it would just become kind of like a kid movie kind of, you know, and not that there's anything wrong with kid movies, but there's like playing for laughs kind of thing without having like real depth to it. And these kids are all like performing real people, you know, they're like real human beings.
Well, that's who they are. I mean, that's who they are. This is their life in many ways, trying to deal with big, complicated issues, you know, like bullying. And that leads me to this next piece of tape where we have Mr. Brown, played by David Diggs. We've mentioned that name already. He gives his kids precepts on the first day of school, or these, you know, these little lessons that he wants the kids to learn.
So, who wants to read this month's precept? What about you? What's your name?
Summer.
Summer. Want to give it a shot?
When given the choice between being right or being kind, choose kind.
Choose kind. You know, kindness, obviously, a theme in this film. Stephen, we see August go through hell at school because of the way he looks. And in some of these scenes that you've created are very painful to watch. How are you hoping to advance this conversation that the country is having right now about bullying?
Look, I have to bring it back a little bit. I'm from Pittsburgh. It's a tough town. And I was bullied. I've experienced it. I've witnessed it. And it was something that I thought, if we show it somewhat unflinching at the beginning, you know, and we don't shy away from what Augie has to go through, then ultimately the fact that, you know, he's such a great kid and he's such a kind kid will learn by his example and his triumph will be even greater. That's how I felt about it. What I will say is, of all the scenes strictly about bullying that meant the most to me, I think was in the scene with Mandy Patinkin and the character of Julian, who's the main bully,
and his parents. Right.
I love that scene. I love what it was trying to do, and the fact that Mandy Patinkin was able to reach the bully, and it was something that RJ had written in her Julian chapter. It was something we wanted to even redeem the bully, because it was really important to show that this issue can be dealt with and people can be changed. And I've seen it in my own life. So that's how I felt about it.
You know, it's an anti-bullying message, but it's more of a pro-kindness message. Augie Pullman is a wonder not because of the way he looks. He's a wonder because despite having been met with so much unkindness his whole life, he still manages only to be kind to other people. And I think that's why people look at him and, you know, they have a hero that they can root for.
Well, RJ, all of this makes me think back to what you told me at the beginning of this conversation when you told the story of seeing that young child with the facial difference and your instinct was to sort of flee the scene. We're all faced with difficult situations like that from time to time. And I just wonder what you wish you had done instead.
Oh, you know, it seems so, I can't even believe that it didn't occur to me. At the time, I was just so panicked and I was afraid of making an awkward situation worse. But now, having spoken to so many families and so many children with craniofacial differences, I'm told over and over again that people get that they look different. It's not a question of the staring so much as, you know, smile. You know, if you see somebody who looks different and you're caught looking or whatever, smile, say hello, don't be afraid. You know, it's that level of sort of fear or uncertainty that is really the rude part. And that's what I'd wished I'd done with that little girl. I wish I'd simply just said hello and how's your ice cream? And even my name is Raquel. That's my son Joseph. What's your name? And, you know, just kind of normalize the whole situation.
That's RJ Palacio, author of the book Wonder, which has just been made into a new film by the same name and directed by Stephen Chbosky. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you. We had a great time.
Thank you so much. Yeah, really. It's great. Thank you so much.
Last month, President Trump rolled back the Obama-era rule that employer health insurance must cover birth control at no cost for women. The Obama rule had an exception for religious employers. They could opt out. The government would handle the coverage with insurers. The new Trump rule adds moral objection to the religious objections. And today, Massachusetts became the first state to respond with a measure expected to be signed by the governor this afternoon. Carrie Goldberg from Here and Now contributor WBUR has taken a look. Carrie, what's the difference with the Massachusetts law?
Well, I'd say that the Massachusetts law is basically saying to Massachusetts women, look, don't worry. Like, no matter what happens in Washington, here in Massachusetts, your birth control is going to stay covered and free. We're basically encoding into state law what there was in the Affordable Care Act. And in fact, we're even going to expand your coverage. So, for example, this new law that's expected to be signed this afternoon requires insurers, in most cases, to cover a full year of birth control pills at once, where until now, women often had to keep coming back to the pharmacy. Or, for example, it requires that the emergency contraception, the so-called morning after pill, has to be covered without a prescription, which is good because when people need it, they need it fast. So, and this law is coming into effect right away after it's signed this afternoon, although insurers have 6 months to get these changes into place.
And this is just Massachusetts insurers. So state law covers the Massachusetts insurers. But what if a Massachusetts employer has a moral or religious objection to covering birth control?
So employers who buy insurance for their workers from Massachusetts insurers can only get an exemption from this new law and opt out if they're a church or another religious institution. If they don't qualify for that category, then they can't opt out of birth control coverage. And if they try, that's probably a matter for the courts.
Yeah, well, and that's the huge difference. People feared that the adding moral objection, that's so wide that many would opt out.
Right.
Look, this executive order was signed by President Trump in early October. It's pretty fast response on the part of the state.
Yes, although we should say that this bill was in the works for months. But still, the passage seemed lightning fast given how legislatures usually work. And it was near unanimous. Here's Ilana Margolis from Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts.
All the stars were aligned to make this happen. It was the right time and the right thing to do.
And she says this law is sending a message to Washington, D.C. and other states.
We're setting an example. We're showing how differing thoughts and opinions can come together and find common goals. And we're saying that we're willing to move first, fast, and frankly, furiously to get it done.
What does she mean? Go ahead, Robin. First of all,
you don't often hear an insurer say furiously in terms of how they work. But what she means is that they had to reach some compromises in this bill. They had to hammer them out. And the hammering wasn't between Democrats and Republicans. It was between the coalition that backed the bill, so Planned Parenthood, NAREL, the ACLU, and the health insurers. But they basically all started from a consensus that access to birth control is essential. The bill was called the Access Bill, and it had to be protected. And then they came to agreement on things like 12 months of birth control or vasectomies, which didn't end up being covered. But so they surrendered on a lot of things, but they came to an agreement.
And you are hearing that, and they are hearing other states might follow suit.
Yes. So the backers of the bill say they've heard from colleagues in other states who'd like to try something similar. About a dozen states have already shored up some aspects of their birth control coverage requirements in response to the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. But this Massachusetts law is the first that comes in direct response to last month's rule, and it seems likely there will be more.
Carrie Goldberg, health and science reporter and host of the Common Health Vertical at Here and Now, contributor WBUR. Carrie, thank you.
Welcome.
When you think back to your grade school history lessons, what do you remember about the story of Thanksgiving? It was the early 1620s, right, when a group of refugees fled religious persecution in Europe and set out to cross the Atlantic on the Mayflower. And when those weary pilgrims first set foot in the New World to eventually meet the Native Americans who would help them survive the winter, where did they land? Well, legend says one of the first spots was here, at the prodigious Plymouth Rock.
Well, it's called the great, you know, New England disappointment. People expect to see something that looks like a pier or a wharf that a ship could tie up to and people could disembark. And that's not what we have.
Not even close. Donna Curtin is the executive director of the Pilgrim Hall Museum in Plymouth, Massachusetts. We met on a crisp fall morning underneath the portico at the edge of Plymouth Harbor. Up to a million visitors a year stand on a viewing platform and peer down at a modest slug of granite partly buried in the sand.
So we have the poor little top of the rock that's been exposed, as you can see, to the tides coming in, covering it twice a day. It's covered up underwater. And this placement was done about 100 years ago in 1920 because the rock used to be up on higher ground and people were kind of confused thinking of it as the landing place. It should be down by the shore.
Now, it isn't very big.
The poor rock has been chipped and split and dropped and souvenir hunted for centuries. So we're looking at something that is not in the prime of its youth and glory, but has been used and interacted with sometimes pretty aggressively over the course of many, many generations. So I think we have to give the rock a little bit of leeway in its diminished size in this day and age.
Sure, that seems fair. But when visitors come, and we'll talk to some of them here in just a minute, do they often say something like, oh, that's it?
That is pretty much exactly what we hear a lot of them say.
That's Matt Villamino. He works at the Pilgrim Memorial Park, and he joined us for the tour.
We do point out that about half of it is underneath the beach level, but one of the things that I like to focus on is that it's not the size of the rock that's important, and it doesn't even matter at this point if they actually stepped on it. It's the symbolism behind the rock that really is what makes it important today.
Well, let's talk about that, because most Americans who know something about Plymouth Rock might think that in 1620, the pilgrims landed at this site and stepped upon this rock, but there's a question about whether or not that even happened.
Yeah, some historians are a little skeptical, myself included. The timing would have had to have been just right with the tides. The original settlement is only about 500 feet from us. That's where they built their houses. So they definitely saw it here on the beach. But one of the biggest questions that I have as far as them stepping out onto it is the sailors aren't going to want to break their ship by putting it right next to a rock.
But is it right that it was even 100 years later when the idea that they disembarked at this point even came to be? It was in the 1740s.
Yeah, in 1741, they were going to build a wharf here. And one of the elders of the church, his name was Elder Fonts, he came down here to the beach to say goodbye to the rock. He was in his 90s. And he had heard from his father, who heard from the original Mayflower passengers, that this is where they stepped when they landed here. And he told the townspeople. But it really doesn't for lack of a better term, it doesn't go viral until 1769, when the town people here in Plymouth start celebrating Forefathers Day, and the story is retold.
So at that point, it starts to become almost more of a legend. And at that point also, we're talking about revolutionary times in this country, or in what would become this country.
Just about, yeah. Yeah, and in 1774, right before the Revolution, the upper part of the rock was moved from here on the beach up to the town square. At that point, this was a wharf. It wasn't really the nicest part of town necessarily, probably relatively smelly with all the fishing boats. So they decided to move it to a more honorable spot. Unfortunately, when they were doing that, as they were lifting it up, it broke in half top and bottom. So they left the bottom here in the middle of the wharf and brought the top up to town square.
It literally split in two, which, I mean, there's some symbolism there.
Yes, and some people saw it as a sign that we should split from England.
And ever since then, the rock has carried the weight of its own symbolism. Kathy Swain traveled here all the way from Carlisle, Iowa, and she was expecting
a bigger rock.
But she's not disappointed.
It brings it closer to your heart that your forefathers went through what they went through for you, for me to be here today, standing here talking to you. So that means a lot to me.
And it means something else to others.
Our forefathers weren't the pilgrims. We didn't land on Plymouth Rock. The rock was landed on us.
In this speech in 1964, the civil rights leader Malcolm X rejected the rock's identity as a stepping stone for American destiny.
We were brought here against our will. We were not brought here to be made citizens. We were not brought here to enjoy the constitutional gifts that they speak so beautifully about today. And because we weren't brought here to be made citizens today, now that we've become awakened to some degree and we begin to ask for those things which they say are supposedly for Americans, they look upon us with hostility and unfriendliness.
What do you think about that, the fact that this has some negative connotations to people around the country?
I think that's powerful.
Again, Donna Curtin.
I like to remember when Sojourner Truth came here to visit Plymouth in the 1850s, and a fugitive slave and a beacon and voice for freedom for African Americans in this country throughout her life. And she said, Plymouth Rock to many, you know, symbolizes liberty and freedom. Well, what about the fugitive slave? Does it mean freedom for me? And I think that question still resonates with this. Does this symbol of liberty in America extend to all of us?
Of course, the Native Americans who lived here would say no.
It was the village of Patuxet, and at one point this was filled with the homes, with the weetus, the cornfields of the Wampanoag people that had lived here for millennia before the Pilgrims arrived. They had suffered a terrible illness before the arrival of the Mayflower in 1620, and this village was decimated. There were still bones on the ground, abandoned homes. To the Pilgrims, this was God's providence. They were able to come into this, what they considered to be an abandoned area, and build their homes and settle here with cleared land, and they saw it as a blessing of God. To the Wampanoag people, of course, it was one of the most devastating events in their 10,000-year history.
And that was only the beginning. On Thursday, as they do each Thanksgiving Day, a group of Native Americans will hold a vigil here. They call it the National Day of Mourning.
Yeah, last year we had a couple of thousand people
really?
Out there.
This is Bayo, an indigenous activist who goes by one name. She says over the years, protesters have buried the rock in sand to remind people that the Pilgrims and the Native Americans weren't friends.
Frigid, cold New England weather. It's really remarkable that people do this, and why not? There's a lot of people who are seeking truth right now.
Mm. Any plans to bury the rock in sand this year?
We're not going to let you in on any of our secrets.
Okay. Laughing aside, Bayo says, this is serious.
It is a space of remembrance. It is a space of Native people gathering and allies gathering to remember what the coming together of European settlers actually meant for Native people. It is a day of counteracting the myths and some of the amnesia that we live with in this culture in the United States.
So when Indigenous people stand in front of Plymouth Rock, what do they actually see?
They see and we see that we are resilient, I and many others in the United American Indians of New England believe we move out of the motto that we are not vanquished, that we are not conquered, and we are as strong as ever. And when we see that rock, as we gather in thousands, we see that.
It's a viewpoint that Donna Curtin can empathize with. She took me inside the Pilgrim Hall Museum, just a short walk up from the harbor. Inside, there's a piece of Plymouth Rock that visitors can walk up to.
This is the part you can come in and touch.
It's a cold, hard scrap of American history, and nearly 400 years after it was discovered, it is still prompting us to ask questions about what it means to be a newcomer in this country, even if those questions aren't easy to answer.
Where there's talk, there's hope. And if Plymouth, Massachusetts, and Plymouth Rock can be part of that conversation, I think that's a good thing. Something to be grateful for.
It has been a tough year for some of America's biggest retailers. Department stores like Macy's, Sears, and JCPenney have each announced more than 100 store closings this year alone. Even Toys R Us filed for bankruptcy this fall. At the same time, though, some online retailers are successfully opening up traditional storefronts. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic, and he's been writing about this. He joins us from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hello, Peter.
One of these companies is the eyeglass maker Warby Parker, started online, now killing it offline.
That's right. Warby Parker is one of these stories where initially, several years ago when it came out, the whole story around Warby Parker is that they were making brick and mortar stores obsolete. This
right.
was a place where you could go online, buy eyeglasses, have some models with just glass in the lenses shipped to you, try them on, figure out which one you wanted, and then finally order it online. And people were saying, oh my God, you know, glass eyewear is the sort of thing that's going to go completely online. Well, in 2013, Warby Parker, which had become, you know, the darling of this industry, decides to do something a little weird. They decide to undisrupt the brick and mortar industry and open their first store. And within a year, there are 8 more stores. And now there, I think there are 65 by the end of this year. They're averaging more sales per square foot annually than companies like Tiffany or Ralph Lauren.
Wow.
It's really just remarkable how much they've found. I mean, this is a company that now, Warby Parker, has half their sales happening in stores. And so I wrote this, or I reviewed this story of Warby Parker as this metaphor for the entire industry, for places like Bonobos, things like Amazon, where initially they start off online only, and then they realize, wait, in order to become front of mind for shoppers, let's open stores
yeah.
and sell merchandise there as well. And it's worked out really phenomenally for them.
Bonobos makes clothes. Amazon, of course, bought Whole Foods for $14 billion this year.
Mm-hmm.
So you point out that we should not be thinking about these online retailers and brick and mortar stores as separate things now.
I think it's interesting to compare Walmart and Amazon, and look what's happening right now. Just as Walmart is buying places like Bonobos or Jet, trying essentially to become an online retailer, you have Amazon, which is the king of online retail, buying Whole Foods and its 500 physical locations, or opening its own bookstores and lockers. So the offline companies like Walmart are trying to go online, and the online companies are trying to go offline. So I think I said in one previous piece that the race at the top is essentially that Walmart is trying to become Amazon faster than Amazon can become Walmart.
Wow.
You could essentially say that that's exactly what's happening in the rest of the industry as well, that the brick-and-mortar folks are slowly trying to get into the online business, and the hot online properties are trying to open stores that, as you said, are closing nationwide.
Well, all of this is related to the future of shopping malls, too. You've written that the modern mall will be built around a business started online, not a traditional anchor. That's fascinating.
Well, it's just interesting to think that there's all sorts of new stores that are opening up, particularly in what are called Class A malls. That essentially means malls near rich, dense cities. Class A malls where you have a lot of online shopping companies that essentially just open showrooms, like, say, Tesla or Warby Parker or UNTUCKit, which sells casual men's shirts. So you would go to these places, these showrooms, you would figure out which merchandise you want to buy. Let's say it's a jacket, and let's say it's a bed, and then you would place the order online. So these are malls of the present, malls of the future, where imagine you go to the mall, spend $400, and walk out without a single bag. Hmm. Because all of that merch is being shipped directly to your house. So the role of the cashier is essentially being outsourced and put inside of a warehousing factory or a warehouse itself. So I think it's just really interesting to think that even, you know, the consumer's experience is now this fascinating new blend of online and offline where, yes, we might be visiting stores, but we might not walk out of the store with any merchandise because the order itself is placed online.
But, Derek, not everybody buys a Tesla. Not everybody shops for their glasses at Warby Parker or goes to Whole Foods to buy their groceries. They're higher-end brands, and I just wonder where the inflection point then would leave shoppers who don't shop at these places.
You know? It's such a good point. It's a huge point. In this piece that I wrote for The Atlantic, I talk a lot about how these trends in retail could exacerbate regional inequality, that you have some really healthy shopping spaces in rich, dense cities, these Class A malls, where they're experimenting with all sorts of pop-up shops and new physical locations for online retailers. But what's happening in Appalachia? What's happening in parts of, you know, western Pennsylvania and northeast Ohio? This is where you tend to see more Class C, Class D malls. Malls that are really struggling. And in fact, if you look at where JCPenney and Macy's and Sears are closing down their locations, it tends to be in these poorer areas. So just as you've seen income inequality happen for households, you could also see regional inequality happen within the retail space. And you could have all sorts of malls that are really the glue for certain rural or exurban communities fall apart. And what happens after that, I don't know.
Right.
But it's just to say that this isn't just about like fun games and shopping and what's the future of Warby Parker. No, retail is an enormous part of the economy. And as goes retail, so goes U.S. economy.
Right. And what happens to those jobs? That's another big question. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.